Hello, this is Nancy Clare, and welcome to Episode 10 of Speaking of Mysteries. Today's interview is with Alan First, whose 13th novel, Midnight in Europe, has just been published. Alan's novels all take place in Europe between the years of about 1936 and 1942, the years leading up to and the beginning of World War II. In the interview, Alan talks about why he's chosen this period of time to write about, but it should be noted that in doing so, he created a niche of thrillers that he calls historical espionage or novels about spies. The undercurrent in all of these stories that take place throughout Europe, that are all about ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, is what would you do? The characters in Alan's novels contemplate the rise of Nazi Germany from the four corners of Europe, from the English Channel to Greece, from Spain to Bulgaria. Their sensibilities may be different due to culture, language, and geography, but they share a common threat. There's been a lot of attention paid to World War II in the past few months as the 70th anniversary of D-Day approached. But World War II will always stand out as a backdrop for the eternal struggle between good and evil. As Alan said, it makes for a ripping good backdrop for fiction. And here is Alan First.
We want to welcome Alan First to Speaking of Mysteries, Alan's 13th novel in his series, what he calls one really long book with to date 13 chapters. Midnight in Europe was released this past Tuesday. So congratulations on your publishing date. And let's talk about the book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. And I guess I should start by saying I read Tom Nolan's review in the Wall Street Journal, and I have to tell you that it was Tom Nolan, who I worked with at Los Angeles Magazine and then at the Los Angeles Times Magazine, who introduced your fiction to me.
Oh, that's great.
For that, I am eternally grateful. And he gave it a much deserved glowing review, and I was happy to see that.
As was I.
And then I also saw the New York Times piece on Sunday. You're by the book, and I was going to end with this, but we'll begin. You and I share a love of Edward Gorey. I didn't know there were that many people around who did.
I've had two emails from people I know saying, oh, thank you for mentioning Edward Gorey, my favorite. It's amazing how many people like Edward Gorey and how many people like The Doubtful Guest.
I love The Doubtful Guest, but I have to say my new favorite is St. Melissa the Mothel.
I don't know if they even know that one.
Well, I'll have to get you a copy because it's very I can only describe it as very Edward Gorey-esque because he is an adjective.
Yeah, no, he's wonderful. I think there was a mystery theater production in PBS years ago where they had Edward Gorey drawings for the first stuff you saw, you know, producer, director, this and that. And they had these wonderful drawings of urns and that funny wallpaper he has and all that stuff. It's genius, really genius to find a niche like that that no one ever thought of, you know? I mean, that's really where what genius is, finding what's there. And he certainly did, and it certainly works, and it's certainly quite wonderful.
Well, that sort of genius extends to you because you certainly have found a niche writing about the run-up and the early days of World War II, 1939 to 1942 in Europe. And that brings me to my first question, which is, why did you pick that specific time frame to do these series of books, which hopefully will continue?
What happened to me is, you know, like everything else, kind of strange. I started becoming interested in and reading about the clandestine life of Europe in the 1930s. And the more I read about it, the more I thought, oh, man, this is so cool. There must be a panoramic, spy novel in the period. So I set about to look for it, and I couldn't find it. And then I thought, well, then the hell with it. If it doesn't exist, I'm going to write it, which took a certain amount of ego, I have to say. But that's exactly what I thought. And that's exactly what I tried to do with my first book, Night Soldiers, which covers a huge amount of ground, because I never thought I'd write another one of these. And the other thing about it that's interesting, yes, I did invent a genre, but it didn't come with user instructions. I had to figure out how to do this. And I figured it out over several books. I didn't figure it out right away. Then the next thing that happened, I remember my literary agent at the time, not the wonderful one I have now, but a very good agent and a smart woman. She said, Alan, this book is not going to make you rich, but it's going to change your life. And she was absolutely right about that. Because the next thing that happened was, for a period of 3 or 4 books, the early books in this series, I was like a cult writer. There were people, you know, who loved these books, and they let me know about it. But it was very cultish. And I, as you said, I was a niche author. I wrote about historical espionage. No one else did. Now plenty of people do it. And there's movies and everything else. And I think at least I deserve a little wisp of credit. Can you get a wisp of credit for having started this off?
I think you deserve a tsunami of credit, because not only did you invent it, but you set the bar, and you set the bar very high, which is the reason there are no other Alan Firsts out there, and nobody has said, exceeds Alan Firsts. So in that, you own it. You own it.
I have a name for it. I have two names for it. I decided that maybe what my genre should be described as high escape fiction.
Okay.
Is that okay?
I can see that. Yeah, I can see that.
Because it kind of is. I mean, it's slightly literary. And then the other thing is, through various interviews, a lot of people have said to me, these are not spy novels, and they're certainly not thrillers exactly. And I said, no, if they're not, though, maybe we should call them novels about spies. Which is maybe a better description, because they don't follow formula. I mean, they do in some ways. They surely do in some ways. I mean, I am very faithful to the genre in terms of the kinds of things that go on in the course of a book. There are action scenes. There are erotic scenes. There are scenes where people get to say funny things, and you just work back and forth through these kinds of things as you go through the book. And each time, what I do, if I can I be technical?
Absolutely.
What I do is stack them. I stack them vertically, so that if I'm writing an action scene, I think about 6 or 7 other action scenes I've written in other books. I don't want to duplicate them. I'd like them to be different. Do you know what I mean? But it's almost like different books or different sections. I know what I have to work on. I know what I have to do. And I hope, the thing about writing a novel, you got to have a sense of timing. You know, you've been in Paris long enough. You better go somewhere else. I don't care where it is, but somewhere else. And so the character has to go somewhere else. Well, we're going traveling now. We're going to be on one of those night trains to Berlin. It doesn't matter. It's just like, it's a reader's instinct is what it really is. And what I like to say is that all writers are readers before they're writers. And when they rewrite their work, as I do, you know, I do an incredible amount of, it's all in the rewriting. It's all in the revision for me. I'm a long way from first draft by the time something gets in a book. But that's just the way I kind of have to work. And it's so far so good, that's what I can say, that eventually I do find something that I like and then I keep it.
You talked about how you construct these books within the genre that you invented, and it seems that you start each story with a similar premise. You have a character who's looking at a certain set of circumstances from a different point. Within the books, they are from different points of view, but regardless of the socioeconomic or political positioning, this protagonist has to do something. He's faced with a challenge.
So yeah, they're a very, very sharp reviewer. I think I know who it was. Years and years ago, in a review of one of my books, said the unasked question never stated in Alan First's books is, what would you do? Meaning you the reader, you with the circumstances in which you live, what would you do if suddenly your country were taken over by this terrible power and these terrible people? What would you do? I mean, and realizing that if you did something, it was unbelievably dangerous. You know, I mean, you can, for example, the first thing you'd have to think about is your list of contacts. Know what I'm saying?
The network.
Well, in other words, if they catch you, will they also get all your friends? You are putting people in jeopardy. And this is what happened all over Europe. People did it all right. And I'm going to tell you an interesting story about that. After the war, somebody, one of the governments involved, the Brits probably, did a study, and they went to all the French people who had helped in the networks that got downed pilots out of France and back to Britain. This was important because a trained fighter pilot is a weapon. I mean a real weapon. And people put their lives in jeopardy. You know, 20, 30 people passed this person along from one address to the other and protected them and hid them until they got back to the UK. And then they could fight again. But they were asked after the war, why did you do this? And the answer was always the same. The answer was, because I was asked. It's not the answer you would come up with. It's not a moral answer. It's something a little different than that, although in a very deep kind of anthropological way, it is the answer as to why people did this, because they were asked. And they said yes.
But did they go any deeper to find out who asked them to do it, or just it was just part of this network, this self-preservation network that the French had created?
Well, no, I mean, it's the French didn't create it. The people created it. It's like if you yourself, had a pilot hidden in your house, and you know that after 2 or 3 days, this person is going to get hot, and people somehow are going to know, and you think about, well, what friend will I call and say, I got to talk to you personally, you know, and you go someplace where you can't be heard, and you say, look, I have a pilot in my house. I have to put him in somebody else's house. Are you willing to do this? That's like a friend. Think about your friends, and think about which of them would say yes. It's very personal, and I try to make that so in my books. It's not like some big institutional thing, you know, oh, these are the people who protect pilots, A, B, C, D. It's not like that. It's like friends, and friends of friends.
But you do that in your books, because that one of the things I like so much is the protagonist is sometimes a film producer or a lawyer or a journalist, but he has to involve a range of people from the very highest levels of diplomacy and government that he might know to mechanics and farmers and the like. And so I think that that's a a really brilliant way of looking at the societies within Europe and how they really weren't, they didn't function along the lines of conventional wisdom. There was a lot more vertical integration between the socioeconomic brackets.
Yeah, that's true. And that's absolutely true. The other thing to remember is Europe's a funny place. It's got a lot of countries with people who speak a lot of different languages and have a lot of different cultures. This is very fortuitous for me, because if you write a book about Greece, Greece had one historical experience, and it was not the same experience that France had. It was not the same experience that Spain had. It was not the same experience that resistance, that's ANTS, in Germany had. It was all different, and it was very much based on the culture in which this person lived, as it would have to be. So what I made, what made it my business to do, I have a, I have a, an Encyclopedia Britannica from 1952. Not that I don't like Wikipedia, I do, but the Britannica of 52, in this little weeny print, was still very concerned about war in 1952, after 1945. And what I did with that was I would get the article on the country, like Hungary. I would read it like 30, 35 times until I absolutely knew it, until I really knew it. And only then could I start creating characters who would fit into the national culture in a certain way.
But that's, you know, and that's what you seem to do through the breadth of the novels, The Spies of the Balkans. You've got stories that take place in the Baltic, is look at how all of these societies and these cultures viewed the threat of Germany and the rise of the Third Reich. And that's what I meant by you're looking at all of these, you're looking at one thing from different perspectives. We're going to get a 360-degree European perception of the rise of the Third Reich.
That's true. And again, once again, though, you have to remember how personal it is. If I called you and said, tomorrow we're going to be occupied by China, I have it on good information, and your reaction would be, good God, what the heck, what is that going to mean to me? What can I do? What shall I do? And you'd be afraid, of course, as would I. This is terrible news. This is as news as bad as it gets. But that's exactly what happened to people in 1939, 1940, 41. And I go from there. That's where I start, that this terrible thing has happened, and individuals go, what shall I do about it? And then something comes swimming their way in one way or another, and then they have to respond to it. But there's no question about they're not helping and fighting and being on the side of good. I really don't think, you know, the thing about me, one of the lucky things about me, Le Carré's got the Cold War, fine. Wilderness of Mirrors, fine. What's right? Who knows? You know, it's all so complicated. Well, it is not complicated for me, I'll tell you that. I went 20 years back, and there's the war where there was a side of real evil and a side of good that opposed it. And as a romantic, which I am, that made life a lot easier for me as a novelist. There's no question about it. You know what I mean? It's not, there's no question about it.
Did moving to Paris, I think you lived there for how many years? I can't recall offhand.
If I add it all up, I spent about 10 years in France.
I think
7 years in Paris, and then 3 years in, 2 years in Paris, in various 3 and 4 month periods, and then I was a Fulbright teaching fellow at the faculté des lettres in Montpellier, 69-70. And I spent a lot of time when I was in France driving back roads. I'm a big back road driver, one of my favorite things. I love two-lane blacktop. It's absolutely my thing. And I had my roots that I would take through, for example, southern Normandy. And I knew as you entered the city of Drew, D-R-E-U-X, there was like on the D road, that's Route Départementale in France, those are the little roads, there was a church there. And that church had a kind of wall that came out from a straight wall that came out from a round wall, and it made a kind of corner, and every autumn it would fill with leaves. And I would make sure I saw it every autumn.
Did that help inform the writing that you were able to do specifically about France?
Of course, I was in love. What could be bad?
So these books are love letters.
Yes, of course. Of course they are.
To what people accomplished under, very, very extremely trying circumstances, life-threatening, not just their own lives, but the lives of their civilizations.
Their civilization is represented by the beautiful streets of Paris and the buildings and everything. I had the guy that cut my hair in Paris was, I guess, an illegal barber. He had a chair. His girlfriend owned a boutique somewhere in the Marais, I think on the Rue Roi de Sicile, King of Sicily Street. And I talked with him one day about this, and he sort of sighed and said, "Oh, oui, nos pierres, our stones." That's how he thought about Paris.
Do you see any parallels with, this is a little bit off, not one of the questions I'm going to ask, but do you see any parallels between what's being revealed about NSA surveillance and the kinds of intrusive surveillance that were going on and by the Germans and by the people that supported them, the word is escaping me, the collaborators.
You're talking about a very specific thing, and the NSA was doing a very specific thing based on a mission, pretty important, to protect the United States from further terrorist attacks. Did they go too far? I don't know. Let Congress work that out. I don't see serious parallels. We have no Nazi party here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You have to remember that the secret services under Hitler were completely political. They were Nazi party services. The SS explicitly started out as Hitler's bodyguard, and it was a function not of Germany, but of the National Socialist Party. The National Socialist Party had its own secret service. That's very different than other things. That's, you know what I'm saying? It's a political party with a security service.
I understand that. I was just wondering, because some people feel a sense of intrusion and a sense of dread, and what photograph did I send to my Aunt Susan in Brookline, Massachusetts? Is that going to come back to haunt me?
I mean privacy is, and it's not just the NSA, it's Google, it's all kinds of things. Privacy has become a huge issue.
One of the last things I wanted to ask you was about film adaptations and how you felt about the one that had been done so far, and which of your books you think would be most appropriate for a film or a television series adaptation.
Well, the most appropriate book that I wrote for film, I honestly think most recently, is Mission to Paris, about the actor.
I totally agree. I think
Hollywood loves to make movies about itself. I think that would be a very appropriate book. The other one I like is Blood of Victory, which is about the Danube. And it's a very, very visual kind of book, and it has a lot of great stuff that goes on. But in another way, there are many of them that would be good. And what the hell? That would be just fine with me.
We have to make some calls. We have to get this done. I agree with you.
Yeah, you have to make some calls for me. I think that wouldn't be a bad idea.
I think Mission to Paris would be brilliant. Well, thank you again, Alan, for joining Speaking of Mysteries, and I appreciate all the time that you've given us, and I can't wait for the next book, which I'm wondering if you could give us hints about. But
no, I can't, and I won't, but I am working on it, and I do have a great idea and a great title, but you know what? I've learned the hard way, as they say, that maybe the best thing to do is to just keep my mouth shut until I know what I'm doing, because things change when you sit over a typewriter. They just do. You think it's going to be this way, and then you go, oh, no, it can't be this way. It has to be that way.
Well, I'm glad you didn't take that advice for this podcast, and you took the time to speak to us. And once again, thanks again to Alan First for talking to us about Midnight in Europe, and we look forward to the next book, whatever it's called and whatever it's about.
Oh, thank you so very much. This has been a great interview, and I'm really glad I did it.
Next week, Speaking of Mysteries returns to the 21st century to talk to Megan Abbott about her latest, The Fever. No spoilers, but I think it's safe to say that there's probably no darker place than the mind of a teenage girl. And how Megan, with just a subtle, indiscernible twist, is able to turn otherwise wholesome worlds inside out. Thank you again for listening to Speaking of Mysteries. Like us on Facebook, and check back to see who we have scheduled for upcoming interviews. Let us know if you have any questions for any of the authors that we plan to speak to. And please tell a friend about us. Until next week, this is Nancy Clare at Speaking of Mysteries.